You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Alrighty, welcome to the Celtics Lab podcast brought to you by FanDuel, the exclusive wagering partner of the CLNS Media Network. I am Cameron Tiptoe. I'm joined by Alex Goldberg, who's checking in from Brooklyn, his new apartment in Brooklyn, and I'm joined by Dr. Justin Quinn. This is a very special edition of the Celtics Lab podcast because we have a very special guest. This is a person that sports fans like really across the spectrum might know because Jeff Perlman, who is our guest, has written about Bo Jackson. He's written about the Lakers, the Mets, and so much in between. So, Jeff, I'm going to welcome you in and then really dial into what we're talking about. Jeff Perlman, how are you?
I'm doing okay, actually. I'm book research hell for the next book, but that's okay. So this is a little break.
Can you tell us what you're researching or too soon?
I'm doing the biography of Tupac Shakur. So I'm doing my first non-sports book. So, yeah.
Okay. To see if there's a connection to the Celtics, we can have you back on and talk about that book.
He definitely heard of the Celtics.
Yeah. All right. That's good enough for us. Until then, we're here to talk about your book, which eventually became an HBO show. The book is Showtime Magic, Kareem, Riley, and the Los Angeles Lakers Dynasty, boo, parenthetically, which has now become HBO's Winning Time, Rise of the Lakers Dynasty. And our connection there really is you can't talk about the Lakers in the 80s without talking about the Celtics in the 80s. Good enough for us. Yep. Jeff, I'll tell you, the show is tremendous. The source material is tremendous. So off the jump, I'd just like to congratulate you. I hope you're enjoying the ride because it's a lot of fun as a consumer.
I mean, you should always have, if anyone ever comes to you guys and says, we want to turn whatever into an HBO show or a Netflix show or whatever show, you definitely always say yes, because very few negatives that come out of it, you know, a couple, very few. So yeah, it's been cool.
All right, good. That's a hot tip for our listeners. Yeah. Here's how we're going to do this. People who listen to this podcast know that when we have big Jesus come around, we break the podcast into more traditional one-on-one interviews. So Alex is going to hop in. He's going to talk to Jeff about his background, but sports writing and the origins of this book. Then Justin, you're going to kind of bridge the gap between how the book becomes a show and Jeff and the tail end of the program. You and I will talk about the show itself. How's that? All right. Alex from Brooklyn. I mean, we're here to talk about Jeff, but give people your 30-second Brooklyn update because that's exciting too, I suppose.
Sure. Hello, listeners. Nice to see you again. I have been kind of on and off the lab lately, and that's in large part because I've been moving my entire life to Brooklyn, New York to more seriously pursue music and other fun things like that. If you like the music at the top of the program, that's me on the bass. Band is doing stuff. Check it out. Divine Sweater is the name. Anyway, I'm here in Brooklyn now, but I am still a hardcore Celtics fan, which means that the Los Angeles Lakers being a topic on this podcast is confusing and strange to me. But nonetheless, here we are. I guess we have to talk about it. So, Jeff, we're going to just kind of jump right into it. So let's start with how the Lakers even became a topic of interest to you in the first place. Are you a fan? Was it the 80s Lakers specifically, or is it the Lakers more generally? Like, what do we think about this?
I was not a fan. I grew up in New York. I grew up a weirdly diehard New Jersey Nets fan in the 80s, and the Nets really sucked. And it was like, this is pre like Van Horn and, you know, Jason Kidd. This is Buck Williams and Otis Birdsong and Darwin Cook, really bad. But I remember being a kid, and every now and then Lakers Celtics would play in LA, and it'd be like live from, you know, Inglewood, and see, first they'd show the shot of the beach. Maybe they'd have like a couple of people playing beach volleyball in bikinis or whatever, or a couple of lifeguards, whatever. Then you'd go inside the forum and they'd have the Laker girls, and then they'd have like, you'd see like Jack Nicholson and Diane Cannon and Blair Underwood, and then you'd see Magic and you'd see Bird. And the whole thing was just so freaking magical to me. Like, really was that I always like fancied LA and fancied that time period and wanted to touch that thing that was so elusive. So I just always thought about that. And no one had written like a definitive book of that era and those teams, that team. So I just went for it. That's all it was. It was almost like envying what I never had as a kid.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, as much as I admit this begrudgingly, the Lakers are one of two iconic franchises in the NBA whose presence is arguably bigger than the sport itself, at least for some people. So pretty reasonable to pursue that as a topic as a sports journalist. Speaking of sports journalism, you've gotten a couple of different books. Obviously, you're moving into a non-sports journalism project now. But, you know, you kind of made your bones as a sports journalist. And I guess I'm wondering, first off, how did you get into sports journalism? And then what kind of sparks interest in you in pursuing what is a really complex and involved project? Like, how do you go from writing columns and, you know, writing, you know, kind of standard sports journalism to doing such a really kind of thoughtful and deep research piece like this?
I mean, I started, so I went to high school in a tiny town in Naopak, New York, and I wrote for the high school newspaper. And I remember it was either my junior or senior, I think it was my senior year, I wrote a column for the high school newspaper called Cheerleading, Sport or Activity. And at the time I was just this kid who, like, kind of a nerdy kid, you know, newspaper, ran track, that kind of stuff. And I remember writing a column saying that basically cheerleading was just an activity, not a sport. And the day after I wrote her, the day it came out, all the cheerleaders surrounding me and yelling at me in the cafeteria and kind of being like, wow, that was cool. They actually know who I am. They noticed me, you know, blah, blah, blah. That's a very pathetic reason to get into it all, but that kind of did it for me. And I went to University of Delaware, really got into student newspaper, became sports editor and all that stuff. And and I love sports. And out of college, my first job at the Nashville Tennessean as a newspaper guy, actually started as a food and fashion writer and was really bad at it. Then became a music writer, was really bad at it. And finally, they put me on high school wrestling. And I covered high school wrestling for the Nashville Tennessean. I don't want to brag. And loved it. Just loved everything about it. Loved the competition and loved covering it and everything. And my dream as a kid was to write for Sports Illustrated. Like, the dream, books was never a dream. TV show certainly was never a dream. Sports Illustrated was the dream. If you were a kid growing up in the 80s, SI was it. It was the Bible if you were a sports fan. And I applied and applied and applied. And what happened, I had this moment. When I was in college, I had applied early for the NBA draft just to see what would happen. I didn't play college basketball, but I applied early as a junior for the NBA draft. And I got a letter from the league. I remember coming back to my dorm and my roommate being like, hey, Pearl, there's a letter from the NBA. And I look at it and, dear Mr. Perlman, as of this date, you have surrendered your eligibility, blah, blah, blah. I was like, whoa, that's crazy. And then a few weeks later, the head of security for the NBA called me and was basically like, who are you? And I'm like, well, I'm a forward at Delaware. So when I was at the Tennessean, I kept applying to Sports Illustrated because my dream was SI. And they liked my writing enough that they said, why don't you pitch an idea? So I pitched a couple of ideas. And then I pitched, well, when I was in college, I applied for the NBA draft. And they said, write that. I wrote it. And a few months later, I got hired to write for Sports Illustrated. And I was a baseball writer at SI for a good amount of time. And a friend of mine named John Wertheim wrote a book about women's tennis, mainly about Venus and Serena. And I was like, I can write a book. So I got a book deal about the 86 Mets. That was my first book. It was called The Bad Guys Won. I didn't know what to expect. I didn't know what I was doing. The book made the New York Times list. I really loved digging into a subject. I really loved the intricacies of reporting, tracking down people, finding little nuggets and stuff maybe other people didn't know. And here I am with 10 books and a TV show. It's kind of weird.
Not bad. Former Nashville resident myself, I read the Tennessean sports column back in the day. Probably not when you were there, but
you just made me feel old. I know what that secret message was. Probably when you were there, meaning you're older than me. I respect that.
That is true. But yeah, fun newspaper. So you mentioned baseball. First off, gotta ask, New York Yankees, Mets, do you have a side in that rivalry?
Well, I grew up a Mets fan. But then when you cover baseball long enough, when you cover anything long enough, you sort of lose the oomph for it. You know, like, yeah. I guess I'm kind of a Mets fan, but I don't really give a shit if they win or lose. Like, I don't care. The funny thing is, when you're a baseball writer, I said this to someone the other day, in my whatever 5 years of covering baseball, I probably knew 99.5% of all MLB rosters. I could tell you the Dodgers' third string catcher was. I could all that stuff.
That is legitimately really impressive. Sorry.
That's what you did back then. That's what it was to be a national baseball writer. You covered all these teams and you had to swoop in and you had to, you know. But now I probably know 4%. Like, I just don't. Yeah. I don't really know that much. We saw a Otani pitch. That's about it. Yeah.
I recently went to a Mets game and there's not a lot of juice in that rivalry at the moment. Yeah. So obviously, you know, you wrote a book about the Los Angeles Lakers. You grew up, you know, a New Jersey Nets fan. This is the Celtics Lab podcast, though. So we do have to talk about the Celtics. I'm curious, what did you kind of think of the Boston Celtics in the 80s and onwards? You know, what was your impression as a Nets fan? Let's start with that.
Get ready for the NFL season with incredible offers from FanDuel, America's number one sportsbook. Right now, new customers can bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets. Guaranteed. That's guaranteed. Plus, all customers who bet $5 will get $100 off NFL Sunday Ticket from YouTube and YouTube TV. Now is the best time to join FanDuel. It absolutely is. The app is easy to use, and you can be on everything from spreads to player props and more. So visit FanDuel.com/Boston. Kick off the NFL season with an offer you won't want to miss. FanDuel, official partner of the NFL. 21 plus and present in Massachusetts. First online real money wager only. $10 first deposit required. Bonus issued as non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire 7 days after receipt. Restrictions apply. See terms at FanDuel.com/sportsbook. Hope is here. Gambling helpline MA.org or call 800-327-5050 for 24/7 support. Play it smart from the start. GameSitsMA.com or call 1-800-GAM-1234. NFL Sunday Ticket offer ends 9/18/23. No refunds. Terms and embargoes apply. $100 off NFL Sunday Ticket. Not YouTube TV. YouTube TV base plan required to watch YouTube TV. Redemption requires a Google account. A current form of payment. Commercial use excluded. Subscription renews. Cancel anytime.
Hated him.
Yeah. Hated
everything about him. Hated him. They were, them in Detroit were just the asshole teams that you didn't like. You know, like, you only played the Lakers twice a year. So it wasn't like you would really think about the Lakers much. But the Celtics were in the same. They were both Atlantic Division teams. And the freaking, they were so much better than the Nets. Like, so much better than the Nets. In fact, I remember every now and then a former Net would play on the Celtics. And that would actually just burn you. Like, I remember, I think Michael Ray Richardson might have had a cup of coffee at the Net with the Celtics. And you're like, well, that sucks. And I'll probably be good with the Celtics. It was just, I hated Bird. I hated Parrish. I hated McHale. I hated Danny Ainge. I hated Jerry Seasting. I hated Dennis Johnson. Hated Casey Jones. Hated all of them. And when they started sucking, I was probably a pretty happy guy because I just hated them. No offense.
They sucked for a long while. So, you got your 2 cents.
Well, now they're good again, you know, so.
I am curious, just while we're on the subject, what do we think of the Nets-Celtics trade that resulted in the restoration of Boston as a title team?
A monumentally awful trade for the Nets. I mean, that might be... I don't think I could think of a worse actual trade in NBA history if you think about what that did to both franchises. And also, like, it wasn't like... It was just weird. Like, you were basically saying, all right, we have Brook Lopez... And we have Darren Williams as our point guard. So we're going to fortify that with aging veterans. Like, that's not like saying, like, we have LeBron and Bosch. Let's add three more guys. It's like saying we have two good NBA players. Let's add a bunch of aging guys to that. It didn't make any sense. And then it was a first-time coach. Jason Kidd was a first. The whole thing was just such a shit show. That did not work out.
No. So while we're still on the current, and then we'll move on, what are your thoughts on the state of the Celtics-Lakers rivalry now? Because it's a huge topic in the book and in the show. And I guess I'm curious, with both teams at 17 banners apiece, what are your thoughts on kind of, and frankly, with realistic chances to potentially hang another one in the near future, what are your thoughts on the state of Lakers-Celtics?
Well, I think what's cool about it is, if you think about it, you don't really think Lakers Celtics during the season. Like, it's not a in-season rivalry. Like, people don't really talk about Lakers Celtics that much midway through a season, even if the Lakers are good, because they just don't play very often. They play twice a year. But I think it's always cool when it's a possibility and when both teams make the playoffs. Like this year, I never considered the Lakers a legit title contender. I just didn't. Even when they were running in the playoffs, I never did. But I thought the Celtics were. And it is interesting watching the brackets when they get closer and closer and closer. And I don't think you can think of any other teams really like that. We're like maybe Cleveland and Golden State a little bit because, you know, not that long ago. But it's really intriguing. And I know it's not going to end well. But I really liked the Porzingis trade when it was made. I just like, you got to shake this thing up. You just have to. I know it sucks getting rid of a guy like Marcus Smart because of all the, he's a leader and he's the guts of the team. But like, if you look at sports history, those guys are relatively replaceable. And like, I like the trade, but then I also think Porzingis is probably going to end up playing 43 games and hurting his foot in a blender or something. And the Lakers are legit. I think the Lakers are actually better positioned right now, to be honest, to make a finals run than the Celtics.
That's very interesting. I mean, it seems like they've kind of been dancing around each other for the past couple of years. And I think everybody would love to see Lakers Celtics in the finals again, but
it's just fun. And the NBA would love it because it's a guaranteed ratings bonanza. Like people love it.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's get into it then. Lakers Celtics is a crucial topic in Showtime. Tell us, walk us through kind of your process of writing that. Like, how did that idea come up? And then what was it like actually like doing the legwork trying to get this story together?
I mean, it's kind of the same. I could be writing a Tupac book or a Lakers book or like a Brett Favre book. And it's always the same, which is the first thing you do is order every media guide from eBay, make a file for every single person in all those media guides, not just the stars, not even just the players, not even just the coaches, the administrators, the massage therapists, the secretaries, everyone. And you build up this enormous library of people. And a lot of times people make the mistake of thinking, oh, if you don't get Magic or you don't get Kareem, I didn't get Magic or Kareem for the book. Mm-hmm. They think, oh, wow, that's really hard. And it's actually the opposite. Magic and Kareem are two guys who've been asked about the Lakers dynasty for a million times. But Wes Matthews hasn't, and Mike Smrek hasn't, and, you know, whoever you want to pick, even AC Green, guys like that haven't. So for me, it's all about finding the people who are there, but who haven't been recognized 27,000 times, you know? And that was my thing, like digging and digging and digging and digging. Same with, and then you get to the other teams. Like, so when they played the Celtics in the finals those times, you dig through a Celtics media guide and you try to find as many guys from the Celtics as possible. You want to interview guys who are there and people who are part of the team and who were witness to the hellishness of it all. At the same time, you build this library. Like, this is literally my Tupac library right here behind you. And like, jeez. So for Lakers, I had this enormous library, and it wouldn't just be Laker books. It'd be Larry Bird's autobiography and Jack McCallum writing about the Celtics and Bob Ryan and Dan Shaughnessy and all those things. And you end up building these 8,000 libraries and piecing it all together. And then the other thing you do is you like print out, like literally to the right of me, these are some of my Tupac articles, but it's like, I don't know if you can see, like a pile of stuff. So you build this clip collection and you dig through it, and it's basically a combination of original research plus old stuff, finding little nuggets, making it relevant. And this is why I have no life, and I like am always losing my mind, because you become beyond obsessed with what you're working on, to the point where you're just a mindless drone only thinking about Lakers Celtics.
And so you have like a big stack of documents. It seems like you've been reaching out to a lot of people for this book, and were doing so for your other books. I'm curious, what is your balance as far as archival sources versus interview in this process? Because it seems like you use both.
I do. I mean, I'm all about both. I don't even know if there's a balance. I don't remember how many I interviewed for the Laker book. My last book was about Bo Jackson, and I interviewed 720 people, which is a record for me, right? And that's like, it's like you're not just calling. So let's say you're writing about Bo Jackson, and the obvious thing is you call all his teammates. You want to find all his teammates. But you'll also be using archival materials, and maybe you're reading an article about him, and it might be about him buying his first house. And it'll say like Kansas City real estate agent Becky Fernandez sold him his house. Then you want to find Becky Fernandez, and you call Becky Fernandez. Becky Fernandez might tell you, oh, you know what's so crazy? When I was selling him his house, I recommended his gardener. His gardener is, you know, Barry Schmidt. You should call Barry Schmidt. But then you call Barry Schmidt. And like, so starting with the archival material leads you this way and this way and this way and this way and this way. And all of a sudden, you just have this buffet of overwhelming material to work with.
Nice. That's cool. All right. So obviously,
I would say it's not cool. I would say it's the nerdiest thing ever, but I appreciate your kind words.
Fair enough. I'm trying my best here. Trying my best here, man. So obviously, you know, Showtime is a great book, but I think it's fair to say that most people now know it in its TV incarnation. Mm-hmm. And so how did that kind of process to make it a series get started? It says on Wikipedia that Jim Hecht was pretty heavily involved before Adam McKay or Max Bornstein kind of hopped in. So mm-hmm. tell us the backstory of like how you got to meeting all of these people and how this kind of started to gestate from a book into a show.
So Jim Hecht was at the time he was a screenwriter who reached out to me. And when I Googled him, his big movie, his big screenplay was Ice Age 2. And I was like, Ice Age 2. But he was really like persistent. And also he was very complimentary and he clearly loved the book, loved the Lakers. So 2014 Easter, Jim Hecht comes to my house to eat with my family. He's like, I can come by. And we're both Jewish. So it wasn't like we had family dinner. So that was it. I said, all right, come to my family dinner. And Jim shows up. I knew almost nothing about him. And he came to my house. We still joke about this with three things. He came with a block of Saran Wrap Baker's chocolate. He came with a big ass tomato. And he came with a bottle of imitation wine drink. And my wife is like, who the fuck is this guy? And I'm like, I don't know. He's interested in the book. And he was just a really nice guy. And he just had this vision for it as a screenplay. And I wasn't getting any bites on it at the time. And I was kind of naive. So I didn't even ask for money. I was like, all right, whatever, take a year. And nothing ever happened. Like nothing ever happened. Every now and then he'd call me. Him and his partner, Jason Schumann, his business partner, used to always say, we want to make you the male Candace Bushnell. Bushnell, is that her name? Sex in the City. And I was like, I don't even know what that means. I don't even know who that is, but okay. And I just never bought it. I was cynical. And then years later, he's like, Adam McKay wants to meet with us. And honest to God, my reaction was, I don't know who the fuck that is. I don't know that. So I Google Adam McKay. Probably why I'm waiting in his driveway for Jim. And I see who he is. And that's cool. And we go meet with him. And he's very nice. And I love the book. And blah, blah, blah. I think it'd be great. And I'm like, okay, but this isn't going to happen. Because I'm just like, honestly, I'm a Northeastern Jewish guy and we are raised to be pessimistic. Like it is in our DNA that we are required. Right. Worst case scenario. It's always a worst case scenario. What is the worst thing that can happen? That's probably what's going to happen. That's in my dad, my grandparents. So it's me. So I'm like, well, this is never going to happen. And then Jim starts, he's like, no, I'm telling you. And then you start seeing stuff like Adam McKay. I mean, no, excuse me. John C. Reilly signed up to play so-and-so and Sally Field and Adrian Brody. And then they start making it and you're still like, I don't know. Maybe it's cool. Maybe. And then the show's coming out and I'm at this premiere party for the show based on my book. And I'm like, this is the craziest shit ever. And I really do mean it. People are like, is it a dream come true? And I'm like, it's not a dream come true because all I want to do is be a Sports Illustrated writer and cover baseball. So everything since then has been this big cherry on top. And this is one of the biggest cherries ever. It's just phenomenal. So that's what happened.
All right. Last question before I hand things off to Justin. The book is Showtime, but the TV series is Winning Time, right? Rise of the Lakers Dynasty. How did that name change come about? And did you sign off on that or did HBO just do that?
I would say it wasn't my call at all. The weird thing is there's another book called Winning Time about the Lakers that's out there. And I'm like, not only are you changing the name after buying the rights to my book, but you're changing it to the name of another book. But then like, I mean, I kind of understood it. It's HBO. They didn't want to maybe have this conflict with Showtime. The weird thing is now HBO's app is called, I mean, streaming services, Max. And there is a Cinemax out there. So I don't know. Ultimately, what I know is the check's always clear. It's been a dream come true. It's helped book sales. My wife, my kids and I all have had cameos in the show. I've made a lot of really great friends and contacts with it. In regards to Tupac research, it's given me a remarkable amount of cred. Like instead of just saying I'm this guy, I also say I'm also a producer on the HBO show Winning Time. And that's like, even though it's kind of a preposterous thing, it's a pretty decent calling. Winning Time, Showtime. I don't think, honest God, I don't think people care that much about names. I honestly don't. I think after a while, you just watch a show or don't watch a show. So I don't even think about it.
Fair enough. All right, yep. JQ, your turn.
Okay, as a fellow child of the 1980s who has written something very long and involved in my PhD dissertation, one of the things that really interested me about the version that I've been watching on TV is how, and we can talk about this a little bit more a little bit later, how it is a dramatization, which has definitely irked some of the people involved. I wanted to talk to you specifically about the book first. Was that also a dramatization, or was it like really close to The Wire?
Oh, the book was a journalism reporting, fully reporting. There's no dramatization in the book. No.
Okay, cool. So you didn't write the screenplay, but you were consulted. Like, how did that work? Like, what level of control did you have? How did you feel about the dramatization? Like, what was the process like for you?
All right. So basically, a lot of times when people sell their books and their books are optioned, you know, they're given a check. They say, thanks a lot. You can come to set one time and take your photo with this star and move on. Right. And this has been the exact opposite of that. This has been phenomenal from the beginning. They've been gracious and cool. They send me every script. They let me, they asked my opinion on casting for season two, like different things like that. It's been amazing. I'm not in the writer's room. I've never asked to be in the writer's room. I'm not a TV writer. Like, it's not what I do, you know? And it's a very interesting question, because I don't know if you guys are like this, but I'm a horrible audience for sports TV and movies. Horrible. I always use, I've been saying this a lot, and it's really true. Like, I think Moneyball is an excellent movie. I do. But I was a baseball writer at Sports Illustrated during that period. And Scott Hatterberg did not turn around those Oakland A's. Like, they had three Cy Young Award candidates in the starting rotation who never get mentioned in the entire movie, right? They had Eric Chavez playing third base. Eric Chavez was a 30 home run, 100 RBI guy. They had Miguel Tejada at shortstop, an MVP. Like, I can't watch that movie and just be like, oh, this is great. Like, I'm like this. Same with the Jackie Robinson movie, 42. I'm like, and the worst is We Are Marshall, which actually has led to my hair falling out, because I can't, that movie just, you know, like, it's a serious issue. People died in a plane crash and you're just like playing fast and loose because it's fun. So I suck. And I have really had to adjust to this. Like, I've had to adjust. It is a dramatization. It is not a documentary. They do stuff that is interpretive. For example, in the first season, first episode, Norm Nixon and Magic Johnson go to a white party and they play one-on-one. Not a white party like white people, like a white party, everyone wears white. And it didn't happen, right? And when I first read it, I was like, oh, I don't know. But I kind of get it, like what they're trying to do. And I actually talked to the actor who played Jack McKinney in season one, is a really, really well-known playwright named Tracy Letts. And I had Tracy on my podcast and I asked him about it. I was like, are you bothered at all by sort of Jerry West? Should we be bothered at all by Jerry West being upset by the show? And he goes, not even remotely. He's like, real life is not interesting. That's just a reality. Real life is not interesting. And if we just did, you know, shows like this that are real life, well, you'd watch Jerry West pull up in his parking lot to the forum, and then he'd go to the bathroom, and then he'd shake some hands, and they'd file out some papers. And like, it doesn't work that way. And I've accepted it. And maybe I'm a hypocrite. It's a fair point if someone wants to say I'm a hypocrite, because I do get paid for the show and it certainly helps my book. But I've just had to accept it. That's all you can do. It's not easy. It's not. But I've just had to accept it.
There's a thing in anthropology called the crisis of representation, and it deals with a lot of what you would expect, the representation of the people you're dealing with and trying to represent in your work. And, you know, in my own work, I've had to hide the identity of some of the people I've worked with for political reasons, because it could be retribution for the stuff that they shared with me. And that kind of sat with me a little weirdly at first, but like I grew in this very similar and parallel way to kind of see the wisdom of it. But then, like, when you were mentioning like the Marshall situation, that immediately drew my mind to one of the more recent examples in the series where things aren't exactly as how they were on a really fraught subject, which is Larry Bird's father appearing while he was in college, which by then he was dead from suicide. But they also handled that situation like in a really thoughtful manner. So I don't know, did you, when you saw that, did you feel like they did that particular scene justice? Because it was admittedly a really touchy scene.
I have mixed feelings on all this stuff, just as far, not just with the show, like in general. I have, because like when you write books, you can't do that. Like you can't do that. You wouldn't do that. You wouldn't even think to do it, right? It wouldn't even be a thing. I mean, it's just a different medium. Like that's being honest. I'm actually being honest. It's just a different medium. It's not my medium and it's not my world. Like, do I like that stuff from a journalistic standpoint? Of course not. But it's not journalism. It's storytelling. And I mean, it would be weird. Like to me, it would be, all right, like a perfect example is The Blind Side, everything going on with The Blind Side right now in that movie. And like that kid was already at that high school. In real life, that kid was already at that high school when he met that family. That kid was already an excellent football player when he met that family. That woman did not, the little kid did not have to take ketchup bottles and show him how to play football. And I'm so disturbed by that movie in hindsight. I was at the time, but I really am now thinking about it, how they basically made up everything about this kid.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
I feel like, at least in the defense of the show, it did happen. They fucked with the time, period. Is that cool? I guess it depends on your... I could see it either way. You know, I could see it either way.
Yeah. I don't know if there's really a way around that either, too, because as you were alluding, you know, real life is boring. And even if you are representing people fairly faithfully, it's not uncommon for them, even when you have a recording of them saying a certain thing, for example, for them to push back and deny that it actually happened. So it's a really hard needle to thread. I don't know if I have a good landing spot for that because it is such a difficult topic. But what I think I will do is hand this off to Cameron to talk about the rest of the series on some maybe less anxiety-inducing topics.
Right, I want to make one point about that, though, because I actually think it's a hell of a question. I think it's a great question. And I, honestly, like, what happens is, like, generally when people promote stuff and, like, actors come on, so there's an actor strike right now, so there's no actors here, right? And you get someone like me. I'm like, you know, this is everything, books, movies, TVs, whatever. You get people and they prepare you how you should answer these questions and blah, blah, blah. If they ask you this, make sure to sidestep it, blah, blah, blah. I think that's a hell of a question. And I actually think like it is a fair, again, the We Are Marshall test. Like as an example, they're on the plane's about to crash. The coach says to the team, "We are," and they all go, "Marshall," right? Well, they didn't do that chant for years later, right? And it's a small little thing, but like, it bothered me. It really did bother me that like you're talking about a plane crash that changed the lives of so many people. You're talking about the ramifications of with people aren't born. People don't get married, like families forever change everything about it, the shrapnel of that. And to just come along and fuck around with that is kind of crazy. So I don't know. I guess we all justify what we do. Like that's one thing we all, as a journalist, I justify my existence all the time when I will interview someone in a really uncomfortable situation and have to ask myself, is this really, am I doing any good with this? Or am I just being an asshole and doing my job? I just think that's one of those things we all have to deal with. And it's really, there's no great answer to it.
I like how you put that. The personal introduction of ethics is something that I think is not given enough attention in modern media at any level, whether we're talking journalism, Winning Time, or I don't know. The coverage of, you know, the incident that just happened in Florida with the white supremacist, which we don't need to talk about any more than I just did. But I don't know, very heavy turn, but I think it is definitely worth something for us to keep talking about in terms of the ethics of representation, even in something fairly lighthearted as sport, because sport touches on the rest of our real lives as we have been, you know, touching on. And yeah.
Why just wait? I saw the other day something. I know this isn't about this, but like I saw the other day when there was a political rally and Trump was mocking Chris Christie for being fat, right? Mm-hmm. And I was thinking, like, how many people in that audience are overweight? And somehow or another, they're able to laugh and justify him mocking someone who's overweight. And I just think we all sort of find a way to justify whatever we need to justify. You know, mm-hmm. it's a weird human thing we do. Maybe it's a survival mechanism. I don't know, but it's very strange.
It is.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't know if you heard Trump is 6'3", 215. I mean, that guy's built like a linebacker, evidently.
The crazy thing is I'm 6'3", about 200. I'm almost 6'3". I'm like 6'2 and a half. I mean, it is preposterous when you're near those dimensions to actually look at him and think he's those dimensions. I was like, he's got to be closer to 315 than 215.
Oh, he's got to. There was something.
He's a handsome man. He's a dashingly handsome man, and that's what he is.
I mean, his hair, it's the envy of.
Glorious. Yeah.
Well, so Jeff, I don't know if you know this. So I'm a history teacher. Alex is a history teacher. And Justin is a doctor of anthropology. So how stories get told is not incidental on this podcast. Mm-hmm. Which is why sometimes our podcast comments are like, these guys are so nerdy. What the hell is going on? But I mean,
the nice ones.
Yeah, the nice ones. I'm going to stick with that because, and maybe you don't know the answer to this. I don't know that Larry Bird has spoke much about, you know, the incident in question, his father's suicide. Save, you know, an interview I found in the 90s where he said, it was tough. I think I handled it well. And he doesn't elaborate. Do you know if he was CC'd on the second season much?
Oh, no, definitely. I don't think at all, actually. That's my guess. I know that, wait, time out. I will say, I know the show tried to reach out to these different figures.
Sure.
I don't know the specifics of Bird. I just don't. This is the time when I say, look, I just wrote the book. I actually said this to someone the other day. I have like the best of both worlds. If you guys say, I love the show, I can say, oh, thanks so much. And if you say, I hate the show, I can say, I just wrote the book. So in this regard, I just wrote the book. I do not know the answer to that.
Yeah, I mean, I'll leave that ethical parenthetical like hanging out there. I don't really know. Like,
I don't either.
I thought it was an arresting episode. I'm sure it was meaningful to a lot of people, but maybe for the Bird family, they could have any number of reads. I guess a little less serious, but still worth wondering is Jerry West's approach to the show. Maybe you have insight that you can't share, but he threatened to pursue legal action against the show. He didn't like how he was characterized. Although Jason Clark, the man who plays Jerry West in the show, is brilliant. I mean, he's a huge bright spot on the show.
He threatened to go to the Supreme Court, which
yeah,
was a little bit bonkers. Actually, someone said, boy, he showed us how not crazy he is by threatening to take this to the Supreme Court. Here's the thing about Jerry West. I think the depiction is pretty on. I get it. It's dialed up a little bit. There's no doubt about it. But if you are one of the best sports books ever written is Jerry West's autobiography mm-hmm. called West by West or West on West. I think West by West. It's ridiculously good. It's insightful. It's amazing. And he speaks of his own manic behavior, of his own sort of insane intensity, of breaking a golf club out of anger. You know, like, it's all there in the book. So I always say, like, I think the writers on the show, they do not have journalistic backgrounds, right? And unlike me, they're not really used to dealing with athletes when athletes get mad at you. And I have dealt with that a lot. And I think they were surprised by the backlash and maybe caught a little off foot by the backlash. And I've said to them multiple times, and I've said in interviews multiple times, that I always say to them, like, you have to expect that. Like, you're Jerry West, you're home, you're watching your show, this TV show. There's a guy in there, an actor who looks like you, who's playing you. And you're like, well, I didn't fucking say that. Or that wasn't, like, you have to understand it. And then on the flip side, I do think people like Jerry West and Magic Johnson and Kareem, if they're watching the show, are a little bit missing the level of homage this is to that era and to those teams. Like, this is homage. This is straight out homage to them. And I mean, I get why someone would be upset, but I also think, like, if you watch a clip, I think it's a love letter to Jerry West. I really do. I'm not just saying that. I think it's a love letter to Jerry West.
You know what? My theory is that the showrunners, people who love sports, it is a love letter to Jerry West because you know what he accomplished, you know where he's going next, you know how brilliant he is. But like, I watched the first season with my girlfriend who is not a huge basketball fan. So for example, I was getting tired of the Magic and Cookie phone calls early enough because we knew where it was going. And she didn't know that they end up together. So she was really dialed in. Whereas as someone who knows what happens next, I was like, all right, got it. Let's keep it moving. If you didn't have, I bet everyone on this call thinks very, very highly of Jerry West. If you were coming as a Jerry West noob, he's somewhere between manic and derpy in the show. So maybe that's where the real life Jerry West is coming from. And maybe the showrunners don't pick up on that.
It is interesting. Wait, because I watched recently, there was a 6-part or 5-part documentary on Hulu about Tupac called Dear Mama.
Yeah.
And I'm working on a Tupac book, so I was riveted by this documentary. And my wife was kind of confused. She was like, because she's not a big hip hop fan, not huge. And it kept going back and forth to Tupac's mother, Feeney, who was in the Black Panthers, and it got kind of jumbled. And I was like, this is fantastic. And she's like, I don't really like it. And I do think it, I don't know how much showrunners, screenwriters, et cetera, I just don't know the answer to this, take into account that we're going to have various degrees of knowledge observing our show, and we should cater to this. I just don't know how that works or what they're thinking.
No, I don't know either. I mean, I don't want to get off topic too much. I kind of had that concern with Oppenheimer. It made me feel like it insulted my intelligence and that it knew that I was a history teacher.
I just want to say, I'm happy to have this real quick. I was with a friend last night. I was with two friends last night. We're both much wiser than I am. And they were bored by Oppenheimer. And I was like, I'm so happy you say that, because I was a history major in college. I'm a history buff. I was bored. Like, I was bored after. I thought that movie should have been an hour shorter. And I know that's
big time.
Yeah. And like, everyone's like raving about it. And sometimes you wonder if people rave about stuff because they're just supposed to rave about it versus they genuinely loved it.
I thought the first half was gripping and the second half really petered off.
Yeah. Well, I have the opposite concern, and then we'll go back to basketball, which is the first half was gripping, but we knew the bomb was going to work. So there were no stakes, right? And then the second half, I actually loved. It was like Aaron Sorkin. It was a crime drama. But you were so tired after watching a 2-hour movie that I was like, we're really going to watch an episode of The West Wing now? What is this? So anyways, that's Oppenheimer.
I just want to say we did the Barbenhopper. Barbenhopper?
Oh, I loved Barbie.
And I thought Barbie was a better fucking movie.
Oh, big time.
Yeah.
I thought it really handled my intelligence well. It just was like, hey, this is what it is. Buckle up. I thought it was great.
Yeah.
Whereas Oppenheimer, they were like, the Germans think it's hydrogen, but we know it's nitrogen. And then they like draw something on the chalkboard. And I was like, all right, thanks. Thanks, movie. Okay. Right. Anyways. So Jerry West's depiction, we think, is probably true to life. Some people haven't loved it. Quincy Isaiah as Magic has been a revelation. I know, again, you can't claim that, but any thoughts on Quincy Isaiah or just like any other portrayals in the show?
Man, I'll tell you a few things. First of all, this I really mean. Kareem Magic Bird, they could have cast that for the next 100 years, and I don't think they would have found any better guys than those three. I just think it's a trio. Yeah. Quincy, his real name is Quincy Crosby. He goes by Quincy Isaiah. He was a football offensive lineman at Kalamazoo College with almost no acting experience whatsoever. Mm-hmm. Very young, you know, I think he did local theater, maybe community theater, but that's it. And it was like needle in a haystack, awesome. Kareem is Dr. Solomon Hughes, who played center at Cal. And he's not that much younger. He's about 42, you know, but he's also like, he's a PhD. He's very intellectual and he's really smart. And it's all cliche, but it's true. Like he has his Kareem, like,
yeah, that's perfect.
Quiet about him. That's really good. And they're both awesome. Like they're both like really good hangs. Like they're just good people to hang out with. And Sean Patrick Small, the original Bird was Bo Burnham, the comedian, originally cast as Bird, and he dropped out. And Sean Patrick Small is he's really a writer, and he lives about an hour north of me. He's from Northern California. And there's a Seth Davis book. Seth is a former colleague of mine at SI. He wrote a book about Magic Bird and Michigan State, Indiana State game. And Sean had optioned that because he wanted to write it as a screenplay, and he wanted to play Bird in the adaptation that he wrote. Bo Burnham drops out. Somehow Sean finds out that they're casting for Bird. He reads via Zoom, I think, on like a Friday, and he gets cast on a Monday. About 6 weeks ago, he's a great guy. About 6 weeks ago, he shows up at my, I play pickup basketball every Saturday morning, and I've been bugging him to come down and play. And he shows up. He's in real life, he's 6'4". He played high school ball, good player, probably college intramurals, all that stuff. He shows up and he tells me that he shoots just like Bird now. Because in training for the show, they remastered his shot. So he actually does. He has the exact same high release point as Larry Bird. And he's a really good player. So he shows up shooting like Bird. And, you know, they just like, they really got it. Like they really, really, really got it with those three. And it would have been predictable if they found like the hot young African-American actor to play Magic Johnson. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
You know, whoever Michael B. Jordan is 10 years younger, like we got this guy. He was in this show and this show and this show. But you look at him and you're always thinking, oh, that's Michael B. Jordan. And like, Quincy just oozes. He oozes this thing. He has a really beautiful smile. He has this thing about him that's like cool and confident, and like they just somehow nailed it. It's insane.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
I mean, it's like I said off the jump, first of all, the show is carefully well-made, but the source material is great. Like, Dr. Buss was a character. Magic Johnson is a character. Like, it just works. Okay, a couple kitchen sink things and then we'll let you go. Just while we're on casting, Devon Nixon plays his dad, Norm Nixon.
Yeah.
How did that come about? And have you talked to Devon about playing his dad?
Yeah. Well, so little known fact, Devon played Whitney Houston's son in The Bodyguard. So he's he was a child actor. He was in a bunch of stuff. You look at his IMDb page. And actually I was with him my wife and my kids and I were all in. We all been in the show, and the day I think my kid shot, Devon was shooting the same scene. He was in that scene actually. And the funny thing is, I think his dad has been insanely hands off about it all. Like, kind of like, you do you. Because I think it's probably the gateway to a healthy father son relationship, you know, is like to not have your dad overlording you. And the thing, I remember when I wrote the book, I went, because Norm Nixon is married to Debbie Allen. The former, I don't know if you guys are a little young, but Debbie Allen was in Fame and she's a famous actress and she's been in a ton of stuff.
Okay.
And she runs a dance studio. And I interviewed Norm at the dance studio and I met Debbie Allen. Debbie Allen was a childhood crush of mine. So I was like, oh, Debbie Allen and Norm Nixon, but Debbie Allen, what? And I just think that the whole thing for Devon has been like, his dad has kind of stayed out of it and he's done it. He's also in Snowfall right now, Devon Nixon. The guy's it's a big statement. He might be the best actor in the show. Like everyone talks about how preposterously talented he is as an actor. He oozes that thing. Yeah. Like when you see him on screen, he really I hate to be this bullshit Hollywood nonsense, but like you do keep your eyes on him when he's on the screen. He kind of has some sparks coming off him.
And the first episode, two episodes where you meet him, it's like, oh, they're going to use him as a heel to tell the story. But it's like, no, he deserves all the oxygen he gets in the room. It's really 100%. Good.
He's great. It's great.
Quick shout out. His dad has a podcast on our network. I can't remember its name right now because I'm an excellent plugger, but just go look for it on the NBA History and Legends channel on CLNS Media.
I think it might be with Michael Cooper, actually. I think it might be two of your enemies. I think it might be Nathan Cooper. Yeah.
I think you're right about that because there is a lot of synergy between the Lakers and the Celtics when it comes to podcast making.
Yeah.
Tell us a story if you have. Your cameo, how'd you do?
Well, I technically have two cameos, but I had one in the pilot episode. My wife and I both were shot the same day. My wife ended up getting a laugh. She actually laughs. She plays the Chicago Bulls administrative assistant, and I'm just a reporter, so you see my back. But this year, I'm in episode 5. I play reporter at a press conference. I get to ask 3 questions. John C. Reilly as Jerry Buss calls at me and actually calls me Jeff. It's a nice little thing, you know?
Yeah.
I was super excited. I got there very early to the Warner lot in LA. You do wardrobe, which is cool. You have your own trailer with your name on it, which is cool. They do makeup. I had a wig and everything put on. Cool. Craft services. Cool. I go to this. I have time to kill. The set of Abbott Elementary is right next door. So I'm walking around the school buses.
Wow. Very cool.
Cool. And then it's time to film the scene. And they take you over to the set, and I'm a reporter at a press conference. And I literally, not joking, had my lines written on my hand because I was so nervous. They're like 3 lines. I could recite them now for you. Like, they're not hard, you know? But like, so they shoot it. I do it. They shoot it again. I do it again. Shoot again. I do it again. They shot that scene. I think I had as 104 times total. I was there from 11 in the morning to about 9 at night, maybe. It was dreadful. It was so boring. And hot and itching. My head started itching. This is the worst part. My head starts itching. And I'm like, I don't know. I get home and I have bumps all over my head. And I actually asked another cast member, I don't know what's going on if I'm having allergic reaction. She's like, take some Benadryl. I take Benadryl. Next morning I wake up, my head is just enormous. It's like a pumpkin. What? And I go to urgent care and I'm having an allergic reaction to the wig glue that they used on my head. So basically I was there for 100 gazillion hours. It was boring as all anything. I had an allergic reaction. I had to go to urgent care, but it's one of the coolest things ever to have as a little clip in my life, you know? So.
Yeah, that's showbiz. Why so many takes?
They're just meticulous, as you can imagine. Different angles. We have to use this camera. We used to have that camera. We're going to shoot with this. They do some of the footage with the Super 8, which is like the old fashioned camera. Yeah. Yeah, it was a grind. It was a grind. Like, it was not, I could lie to you guys. Like, a lot of people, I think, would promote a show and be like, oh, it's the best. It was the worst. It sucked. It was horrible. But the people are lovely and professional and cool. And I'm glad I have it. But I've told this story a few times. Years and years ago, I did a story for TV Guide. And I went to the set of a TV show called Love Monkey. And it was like Tom Cavanaugh, Jason Priestley from 90210 was in the show. And I remember interviewing Jason Priestley after watching them shoot the scene like 30 times. And I said, I'm going to be honest with you. That seemed kind of boring. And he goes, brother, you have no idea. And I feel like now, 20 years after Love Monkey, I have my own idea.
Yeah, you got to follow up. You got to go find him.
Yeah, find Priestley and be like, you were right, buddy.
All right, Jeff Perlman, I'm going to give you 3 quick questions and we'll get you out of here. How's that? Just to justify you coming on a Celtics podcast, Rick Fox was consulted for the show, and obviously he bridges the gap between the Celtics and Lakers. Any conversations with Rick Fox? Any Rick Fox stories?
I love Rick Fox. So first of all, it's weird because first thing that entered my head, when news first came out that Kobe Bryant had crashed, like first news, someone texted me. Mm-hmm. And I was in a corner bakery writing, and someone texted me, did you hear about Kobe? And I said, what? She wrote, died in a plane crash. And I was like, what? A helicopter crash. One of the first people I texted was Rick Fox to see what he knew. And actually, the initial reports right after that were Rick Fox was on the helicopter.
Yeah, I remember that.
He ended up not being. But he was one of the first guys I texted. Rick is a really nice guy. And he hated Rick Pitino. I mean, he's not alone in that, obviously. But he felt, I remember, because I ended up writing, I wrote a follow-up book called Three Ring Circus about the Shaq Kobe Lakers. And obviously, mm-hmm. went from the Celtics to the Lakers. And he basically said, I mean, in not so many words, Rick Pitino was a dishonest piece of shit, you know, and that he didn't keep his word and blah, 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 blah. So,
yeah. That sounds familiar. I keep getting notifications on my phone about something familiar.
Yeah. He's Rick is a really cool guy. He's super, you meet him. My wife was like, we went to a screening and Rick Fox was there. And my wife was like, oh, Rick Fox. And I was like, you can shut up now. You know, like, he still has like that dashing cool thing that, you know.
Well, he used to live in Watertown, which is a suburb in Boston. And so he used to be like a little bit of a man around town. I think he lives in California now.
Very nice guy. Legit nice guy.
Yeah. No, high on my list of, I'm sure you've had this experience where most of the time you play it cool when you meet people you look up to. Rick Fox is someone, I don't know that I do a good job with that.
You like my wife going like, oh, Mr. Fox. Hey.
I mean.
That's okay.
Look at him. He's aged like a fine wine, a fine non-alcoholic wine. This is a selfish question. Do you know Neil Best personally?
I do not.
I thought maybe because of the Newsday. Okay. thought I'd ask. Okay. You have a podcast. Is that correct?
I do.
Plug the product.
Oh, it's called Two Writers Sling and Yang. It's a different journalist every week. It comes out usually Monday evenings. And I just love talking shop. Like, I love talking shop. I don't make money for it. I produce on my own, just gets a couple of thousand listens every week. It's not huge, but like I had Adam McKay on, I've had Jimmy Kimmel on, like I've had some big guests. And then mainly it's like I had Dan Shaughnessy on, you know. For good or bad, I know. But I, you know, different writers and different mediums, and I just dig talking writing. I really do.
Well, that's perfect. My last question was gonna be, who's a one guest, past or present, that would be like absolute tops for you? I mean, I'll let you think while I do our outro. How's that? Okay, so this episode of the Celtics Lab podcast was brought to you by FanDuel, the exclusive wagering partner of the CLNS Media Network. We've been talking with Jeff Perlman. He is a author 10 times over, 9 times on the New York Times bestseller list. I think I have that right. Maybe it's 10. Yeah.
And or you can say the accurate number, which is, I think, seven.
Or seven or several. We do history. We don't do math on this podcast. All right, Mr. Perlman, who would be the cream of the crop as podcast guest?
Yeah, I just thought of this. When I was in college at the University of Delaware, my the guy who changed my life in many ways was a professor named Bill Fleischman, and he was a columnist for the New York Daily News, Philadelphia Daily News. And he became a very, very close friend, guide, et cetera. And not to get depressing, he died about 5 years ago, and I never had him on because it was very early in the podcast. And that's one of my regrets. So if I could go back in time, I would get Bill Fleischman on.
Wow, I love that. Oh, I'm getting a little emotional. Thank you for sharing that, Jeff. Okay, well, Jeff, anything you want people to check out twice, be on the lookout for?
I have my Bo Jackson book called The Last Folk Hero. It comes out in paperback, I think, next week or 2 weeks. And I don't know. Watch the show. I would say this, honest God, this is what I'll tell you. I want the show to survive. It is really hard times. Actors can't promote. Writers can't promote. It's basically up to people like me, the people nobody wants to hear from, to promote. And this show needs views. It's an expensive show. It's a great show, but it needs views.
Really good.
If you could just encourage, honest God, I would, if your listeners and fans or whatever could just support the show, even though they're Celtic fans, there's hardcore Larry Bird. There's a lot of Larry Bird love. The last few episodes, a lot of Celtics, chunky Celtics. So if you could just watch a show, I'd be so appreciative.
Yeah, whoever's playing Red Auerbach has also nailed it.
Michael Chiklis.
Yeah.
Oh, killing it. My age, geez.
Just saying real quick. They had a premiere party last year for the first season. It was the best party I've ever been to. It was probably a better night than my wedding. And not only that, my wife wasn't even in town. She was out of town. So I took my kids. And my kids are both teenagers. And we go to this party. And it's the greatest thing ever. It is the greatest thing ever. They send a car for us. They have a red carpet to walk. Oh, there's Jason Segel. My daughter loves Jason Segel. Can you take a picture of me? Sure. The whole thing. And my daughter goes, they had a cigar rolling station with Winning Time labels on them. So it's like, wow. We're at the premiere of a TV show based on a book I wrote, and they have a cigar station. My daughter goes, we should smoke cigars. And I'm like, first dad of the year moment. We should smoke cigars. So me, my daughter, my son, who was probably a sophomore in high school at the time, my son was like, I don't want to. I was like, you're trying a cigar, damn it. We all took puffs of a cigar with the actor who plays Red Auerbach, Michael Chiklis.
Oh, man.
Very cool.
And I feel like it's okay to be a bad parent every once in a while. In fact, sometimes being a bad parent makes you a good parent.
Yeah, no, totally. Particularly if you have a chance to smoke a Red Auerbach cigar, or at least the closest you can get to that.
We all snorted Coke together. Is that bad?
Yes, of course.
It's just different. It's just different. There's no good or bad.
Strokes were different.
All right. On that unbelievable anecdote, Jeff Perlman, congrats on all the success. Thanks for spending time with us. This was great. And give us a ring when Alex plays bass in a successful band. That's good enough for us to have you come talk about Tupac.
Oh, yeah. Let's do it.
All right. Thank you guys so much. I really do appreciate it.
Thanks for your time.
Take it easy. Thanks, everyone. Like and subscribe. We'll see you later. Adios.